to teach a horse to be led force-free, we use targets. So we teach the horse to touch its nose to the target and it gets food in return. And then we start to throw the targets so that they then follow the targets along the ground so that we can influence their movement. But that's not going to happen in 3 seconds, whereas you could lead a horse in a few seconds with a halter and lead rope. But what does it do to the relationship if, in order to get you to perform a behaviour, I have to make you uncomfortable?
Welcome to episode 13 of the Anthrozoology podcast. Episode 13 introduces a new series where we ask people who work with animals to share their stories and chat about their impact through an anthrozoological lens.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our first episode of Anthrozoology Speaks, which is a special series as part of our Anthrozoology podcast.
Hi, I'm Michelle Sidlowski. I'm an assistant professor at Beacon College in Leesburg, Florida, and a member of the University of Exeter EASE group.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm doing my PhD with Exeter University and also a member of the EASE group.
Hiya, I'm Emma McLean. I'm the founder of Hound Charming. I also work as a horse trainer, force-free at Horse Charming, and I'm a qualified canine behaviourist.
Hello, my name's Sarah Oxley-Heaney, and I'm a part-time PhD student at the University of Exeter, and I'm also a member of the EASE group. Welcome, Emma. Welcome to the first Anthrozoology Speaks podcast. So first of all, I was wondering if you'd be able to tell us a little bit about force-free training, the concept, and then about how you came, how it came about that you got into force-free training, especially with your story about Flynn. Thanks.
Yeah, sure, no problem. Okay, so I mean, force-free training, there's probably as many definitions of force-free training as there is force-free trainers. But my definition, boiled down into its simplest kind of form, is force-free training is putting the animal's physical, mental and emotional well-being at the centre of what we do. So if we're not working with an animal that is pain-free to the best of our ability, calm, happy and relaxed, then we want to be thinking about making changes, basically, either to its environment, to its medical treatment, to the way we're approaching our training. You know, it puts the onus on us as the human animal to make adjustments to accommodate the animal and who they are and how they are at any given time, basically. And how I got into this style of training was I came from a very much traditional pet kind of ownership, for want of a better word. I had horses and dogs, and I kind of copied what I saw on TV. I had traditional training in terms of riding horses and handling horses, and I'd been in that kind of world for quite a long time, and had done kind of okay in terms of competitive riding and riding for sport and things like that. And then about 6 years ago, I bought an ex-racehorse called Flynn, and he was 2.5, and he'd already failed, for want of a different word, at being a racehorse because he wasn't fast enough. And I thought, I'll buy a cheap horse and retrain him to become a competition horse for dressage, which is the thing that I was interested in at the time. And I had a vet out to do an assessment of him. It's called a five-stage or a five-star vetting. And the vet said, yep, he's good to go, basically, and he's a very lovely horse and all of this business. And you know, you're very lucky, his temperament is absolutely spot on. He was very quiet, very compliant, you know, did everything he was asked to do, you know, needles stuck in him, legs pulled around, and there was no resistance whatsoever. And the vet kind of said, you're getting a good one here. And then I brought him home, and very quickly I started to see different behaviours emerging, quite sort of rageful behaviours and explosive kind of behaviours. And I thought, feeling a little bit out of my depth now with some of this stuff. And it was getting to a point where I was getting a little bit frightened of him, if I'm honest, because things were happening where I was feeling like really my safety was, you know, seriously at risk. We'd had an incident where he'd bolted on a hack and we were on concrete, galloping, full pelt gallop, no control. And we were heading for a junction where I knew the traffic would be coming both ways. And I couldn't stop him. There was no control at all. And I literally just took my feet out of the stirrups and threw myself onto the ground. And as soon as I did that, he stopped. I understand now why he stopped as soon as I was off his back, but I didn't at the time. And so I'd had that incident and that had given me a real fright. And then he was having some health problems and lameness issues. And the vet had told me, you know, you need to be walking him so many minutes a day and all of that to help with the recovery process. So I was doing it, you know, as prescribed, and he wasn't enjoying it. I wasn't enjoying it. I was getting a lot of resistance from him. And one day he kind of got away from me when I was leading him, and I sort of thought, right, I'm not having that. Went and got hold of him again, and he just went, right, now I'm really going to tell you. And he basically kicked out with his back feet, which were shod with, you know, iron shoes at the time, and got me straight here. And literally I just kind of, like I've been hit by a car, flew through the air, smashed to the ground, was looking up at the sky, couldn't breathe, thought, I don't know if I'm dying or what here, but I can't breathe, and I'm looking at the sky and I can't move. And that was my awakening, basically. That was my moment of clarity that this can't be the way it should be. This isn't right, you know. And I eventually kind of managed to get my breath and sit up. And I looked at him, and he was kind of, you know, a little way across the field looking back at me, and he looked terrified. And for the first time in our relationship, I saw the fear as opposed to seeing the difficult behavior, the inconvenient behavior, the dangerous behavior. I saw the fear. And that led me to want to find a way of training him that didn't evoke that emotional response in him anymore, basically. And that's what eventually got me to force-free training, because that's what it's about: putting the animal first, putting them at the center, asking what they need, not what we need. And that's what I knew he needed in that moment, really.
So did you know what had happened to him then, and why he'd become so fearful, or what you were doing? You said you knew why he stopped as soon as you got off the horse or threw yourself off.
So what I understand now, and what I've learned, you know, I mean, I knew racing wasn't nice for horses. I understood that even back then. But what I now know is that, you know, when we ride horses traditionally, we are ourselves an aversive stimulus, because we're on their back, you know, we're heavy, we're kicking them with our legs, we've often got a bit in their mouth, we're pulling their mouth and their heads one way or the other, and we create in their body a lot of stress in their body and in their mind. So it was me that was the inescapable aversive stimulus, which was causing him to run. So when I was taken out of the equation, boom, off I went. He didn't need to run anymore. I didn't know that then, but that's how I kind of, you know, fathom it now. And you know, arguably context shift as well. You know, something was happening, now something else has happened. Oh, what's that? Arguably that might have been what kind of made him stop in his tracks. But I really do believe that it was me being the aversive presence, kind of literally on him, you know, dominating him, or attempting to. And you know, he wanted escape, you know, he wanted escape, and when I jumped off, we got it, so that's why he stopped running. But yeah, so, and what I now know about horse racing is, or understand about it, is that it is nothing short of systematic abuse from the day that they are born to the day they die, basically. That's all it is. You know, and we hear things like sport of kings, they're looked after, you know, in these immaculate stables, they've got all these grooms and people that take care of them. None of that matters from an ethology point of view for the horse. You know, their species specific needs are not catered for by posh looking stables or, you know, high concentrate feed that makes them run fast. None of that stuff is what they actually need. That's what we do to them in order to help us exploit them. So what I realize now is that Flynn, when he met the vet that day, was in a state of trauma. He was shut down. His emotional responses weren't really showing because everything was suppressed by the life that he'd had. So then when he came here and it was a bit quieter and, you know, he wasn't being put through the ringer as much, he started to emerge from that state of learned helplessness and he started to find his voice. And his voice was damn angry, you know, and I represented my species that had basically abused him since the day he was born, and he had something to say about it, and quite right, you know.
So how did you and he develop a relationship and the relationship of trust then through the force-free training? And
okay, so yeah, I met Max Easy, who I think you probably have come across, and she had set up Horse Charming about 10 years or so ago, I think. And she had developed a way of training horses, a pathway, she calls it, Horse Charming Pathway, which is a way of training horses without force, without mental or physical pressure or coercion. And it's largely based on positive reinforcement, counter conditioning, systematic desensitization. And we use food or scratches as a reinforcer for desirable behaviour. But the key thing, and the thing that is missing, and we'll probably come onto this later, where we talk about what's good positive reinforcement training and what's not so good positive reinforcement training, is you cannot just get a horse from an aversive training paradigm and start training him with food and expect him to just kind of quickly go, oh, we're doing something better now, this is nice, you know, let's kind of, because they often have that unraveling process to go through where they're, you know, expressing their emotions about the humans that have kind of abused them, really. And you might not be the one that's done it even, but you are representative of your species. And so what we have to do and how we start training horses now is through a process of counter conditioning. So we give the horse a lot of space and we use protective contact. So they know and we know that we can't get to one another. So it kind of sets up that physical safety, because horses are so used to us grabbing them, leading them, putting tack on them, you know, and asserting our kind of will and ourselves on them. And the barrier lets them know that we can't do that. So that's an automatic sort of layer of safety. And we pair the horse, we set the horse up to calmly eat, because they're obviously a grazing animal. They like to consume or need to consume large amounts of low value forage throughout the day. They need to eat for sort of 16 plus hours a day. So we set the horse up to be calm by putting him or her behind a barrier with a big pile of hay or haylage or something like that. And we wait at a distance and observe. And we basically look for the emotional response that we want. And we pair that with more food. So the human comes forward, drops some food. So we then start to change the animal's perception of what human approach actually means, because it doesn't mean they're going to chuck a saddle on your back or drag you in from the field. It means that their presence is a predictor of something good. And that's kind of how we start. But in order to make that a successful process, we also have to abandon force in other areas of their training and handling. We can't do that on one day and the next day jump on his back and ride him. It has to be a holistic approach, I suppose, because otherwise the horse doesn't trust us. One day we mean treat, another day we mean threat. So it has to, you have to kind of grab it with both hands, really.
It sounds very similar to your experiences, Michelle, of elephants in Nepal.
It actually does. I was thinking that very same thing as she was talking, that it is that that's the suggestion that I made as far as seeking consent from elephants to involve them in my research participation. And it is every day their bodily privacy, as we called it, is being invaded. And there needs to be a step back and an observation, so that the human needs to be seen as less of a threat. But sadly, in that situation, there isn't that that same push to take away the fear as there is in the horse training.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what countries are you kind of working with the elephants in at the moment?
I work generally in Nepal. So it's a little bit different situation than a lot of the really heavy timber camp type situations or tourist camp type situations. Nepal is a very different a way of doing things. But for traumatized elephants who have been moved to sanctuary, it's very much that exact same process. There is a training wall built or an enclosed corral where that animal is turned out into the corral and allowed to just be themselves for quite a period of time. As they start to approach the barriers, the humans are just sort of there. And then that gets built up into them initiating contact with humans, because elephants are very tactile. And then the same thing, eventually one of the walls is taken down, and then the elephant has the option to approach the humans or not approach the humans. But it is a very long, you know, more than a year process when you have an elephant with essentially PTSD, just like you're talking about with the horses.
Yeah, that's the thing. It is a time investment for sure. You know, force-free training, it's not necessarily a quick fix. And I think part of what's so gratifying about punitive training for the human animals is that it can appear to be very instant. You know, you can teach an animal to walk with you on a halter or a collar and leash or whatever pretty much instantly by just applying pressure on its neck or on its head, and it will go, oh, don't like that, better follow you then, and the pressure is released. You know, if you're doing it right in terms of trying to train with a punitive method. But you know, to teach a horse to be led force-free, we use targets. So we teach the horse to touch its nose to the target and it gets food in return. And then we start to throw the targets so that they then follow the targets along the ground so that we can influence their movement. But that's not going to happen in 3 seconds, whereas you could lead a horse in a few seconds with a halter and lead rope. But what does it do to the relationship if, in order to get you to perform a behavior, I have to make you uncomfortable to some degree?
We talk about this a lot with our students. I teach in an anthropozoology program, and I ask them all the time, you know, how do you feel about positive reinforcement training? How do you feel about fear-free training, force-free training? And they all, of course, always say, oh, that's what we all do. It's wonderful. This is the only thing that we should do. And of course, then I ask them, really? So you've never forced your dog to do something they haven't wanted to do. You've never shoved them out the door. You've never, and they're all like, oh, well, maybe I have. And then we start talking about children, you know. Certainly positive reinforcement training is the only way to parent, right? But there have always been times when we have said to little Johnny, no, you're coming now, and scoop Johnny up against his free will and put him in the car and restrain him. So as much as we like these methods, we're I think hardwired almost to be lazy about.
Yeah, and we want reinforcement. We want it to be quick and easy, and we want to see a result. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I'm sort of mainly myself focused on children, horses and dogs, because that's kind of my life. And I think horses are probably the easiest species for me to be force-free with, because they live outside. You go to them when it's convenient to you, you know, and you can feed them and then walk away. Dogs live in your home 24/7. You know, if you're keeping them in a kind of force-free system, they generally live in your home. So their behaviours can be more irritating for you. And then sort of up a notch is the children, where you're dealing with an animal that talks back and that argues and, you know, that you have to care for pretty intensively from the minute they wake up, you know, all through the night sometimes, and then it gets hard to be force-free. But I think for me, force-free is an ideal that I want to always strive for, and recognize that I'm a fallible human that falls short of it sometimes, you know?
It's interesting, while you were talking, I was thinking about, I mean, I don't know if Michelle and Chris are aware, but Emma and I are working with a cat that lives in my house, who I'm not going to say is my cat, but a cat I have a relationship with, Foxy, a paraplegic cat from Saudi. And when when he first came to me, he was absolutely terrified of so much, just shake all the time, and very, very frightened of men. He still, even now, I think it's 18 months later, if he's on the floor and Steve walks past, he doesn't like it. He doesn't like, we're in a house at the moment where people walk up and down outside. If he hears a group of men walking past, he'll go and hide in the bathroom. So something's obviously happened to him. But the reason we're working together is because he's incontinent and he wears nappies, obviously, because we want a clean floor. But also I'm very aware that I don't want him to have a dirty nappy all the time. If we need to leave him in boarding, I want the person who's looking after him to understand about his needs. And we found somebody who's excellent and she's actually willing to learn. But before we got there, Emma and I were like coming to it. I wanted to teach Foxy to understand that his nappy was going to be changed. Anyway, so over the last month, we've been working together with Emma's help. And we've come to this brilliant position. And I can't even tell you exactly how it's happened. I've done some things and he's done some things. And then it's kind of like, it's just all bubbled up together. He now goes into his, his room is the downstairs bathroom. He'll go into the downstairs bathroom and he'll do this certain meow. And when he's got a certain meow, I'll go, first of all, if I remember, I'm not going, look, I'll be there in a minute, or shut up or something, because when you're busy, you know, it's like, shush. I remember, no, he's trying to tell me something. So I will go in there. And he's got, because he's incontinent, he obviously can't use a litter tray at the moment. We're working on that next. So he's got a heavy piece of wood upon which a towel is tied around, so he can drag himself onto the towel without dragging the towel off. And he'll go and sit on there and he'll sit himself in a certain position and I can check his nappy. And 80% of the time he's had a poo and I'm able to change his nappy. Then I'll change his nappy. He'll kind of like roll over a bit because he knows what's happening. And then I'll put a clean one on him and he'll go off. And that's just developed. But what has started happening a little bit more is he goes and does it and realizes that's when he gets attention from me. So he's calling, he's trained me now to go.
It does sound like he has embraced the positive reinforcement training of you and has finally had some success in getting you trained. And I imagine you were quite difficult to train.
Exactly. But it's whoever's trained who and however it's kind of manifested itself, it is a much nicer relationship than we had before, where I was kind of waiting till he smelt, then changing his nappy, him sitting in his own, you know, feces until I kind of recognized it. So now at least we have some kind of like rapport over it. So Emma's been absolutely excellent in helping me with that. And who else do you help, Emma, at the moment? I know you've got a specific interesting group of people that you try and assist.
Yeah. So about 80%, I would say, of my clients are people living in the Middle East. So Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. But I also do some behaviourist work for Miracles Mission Charity, who are a disabled animal charity in the UK. And I know we're sort of working backwards and forwards with some dogs from Saudi, hoping to kind of get them here for medical treatment and stuff like that. So I'm a bit of a, I don't know, I sort of started off as a dog trainer and then I kind of got contacts in rescue and now people just send me videos of dogs with a, you know, damaged leg and say, can you get this dog a home and things like that. And I kind of think, I'm not sure you're talking to the right person here, but you think you are. So, okay, we'll give it a go and, you know, do my best. And I've got some really good contacts, obviously yourself being one of them. And it's just kind of, yeah, it's a real community. Like we've got an online community that is for people who have a relationship with Hound Charming in some description, whether that's, you know, a charity or paying clients or whatever. And it's a bit of a, Yeah, it's a bit of a kind of diverse operation now, really, which is great because, you know, part of my kind of living amends to animals is to, you know, try and help them to the best of my abilities. And I've sort of made, you know, that's a living, but also a vocation. And yeah, it's just a really rewarding kind of thing to be involved with. I feel very grateful for that.
I was going to say, Emma, it struck me you said earlier that it's not a quick fix. So, and implying that there's something's already broken. So you're fixing a problem. And the other day I was reflecting on, this idea. And I was thinking about actually my relationship with cats. So I've learned about cats from interacting with cats over the last sort of 15 years. And my cat, she's 16 now, but she taught me how to play catch. It's like, or fetch, it's a game. She started bringing me a toy and I just sort of, I don't know how it exactly happened, but she taught me that cats or she likes to play fetch. And yeah, my relationship with cats has been from cats. And that's a total contrast to how it was with horses. So as a child, I was sort of brought up in the get up there, show them who's boss. And a lot of my training with horses in the late 80s, early 90s, it was very much that school of you get up there, show them who's boss, and sort of push them about and get them to submit. And so that seems to be really ingrained, and I guess that's what you're sort of still dealing with, that kind of cultural I don't know if old school's the right way, but that way of sort of thinking about relationships with horses. So what I'm trying to say is I think a lot of the damaging relationships I've had with horses, that's come from learning about horses from people.
Yeah.
If I'd have just listened to the horses, I think it would have been, like how I've come to learn about cats, just by learning from cats. not so-called experts that...
Yeah, I totally agree with that, totally. And everything about how we keep the modern horse, you know, okay, there are some exceptions and there are good livery yards out there and all of that, but you know, the majority of, certainly in the UK where I live, and I coach people worldwide, so I get to see the environment that horses in, you know, US or South Africa or wherever are being kept, and it's all very much to suit the human needs. You know, horses are fed hay twice a day because the person comes twice a day, or we can afford to pay a groom to come twice a day. Well, a horse needs to eat 16 hours, like I said earlier. So once they've finished their ration of hay in the morning, what they're going to do for the next 6 hours or whatever, you know, it's all to suit us and not actually looking at what the horse needs, you know, in terms of friends, forage, freedom to move, you know, different types of browsing, covering, you know, big areas of ground each day. That's what they're designed to do. You know, their needs haven't changed really, you know, for hundreds or thousands of years, and yet how we keep them has changed so much that it's typical in the UK for a horse to be stabled continuously from October to May, because we don't want to churn up our fields, because we haven't got enough space to really keep horses in the first place, but we want to make money off the land, and that's the way to do it. It's just all about us, and it's all about exploiting them, you know, and, you know, making them suffer really for our kind of wants and needs, I suppose.
So then I want to play devil's advocate for a minute following that, because as we are relearning these relationships with horses, when you're working with someone who has a horse, are you working toward getting that horse rideable? Is the end goal the horse allowing a rider on its back, or is the end goal the horse living a life sort of free of those human impositions?
I can't speak for all force-free trainers. I can only say what I know about how horse charming approaches this. And I spoke earlier about the horse charming pathway, and it's like a layered system. So it starts with, you know, the basics of how the horse is being kept. Is the horse being kept in a species specific way? Are its needs being met? Is there any change we need to make? And often we look at this first stage and there's pain going on with the horse, because horses are very expensive animals to get treated by vets. So owners will often kind of go, oh, he's all right, he's just a bit lazy. And actually the horse is in pain and that's why he doesn't want to move. So there's a lot of kind of eye-opening stuff that we have to try and do with the human in the early stages. But we kind of work through this pathway journey, and you can, at some stage, quite an advanced stage, I mean, I wasn't even thinking about riding horses force-free until I'd been training for many years. You can at one kind of juncture go off to try ridden stuff via a consent process. So I'm not sure if you were talking about this earlier, weren't you? But we have a consent kind of model where the animal can express yes, no, or wait a moment through performing a target behavior. So if they're doing this, that means this. If they're not doing that, it means no more or stop. And we use kind of systematic desensitization and counter conditioning to introduce previously feared stimulus, which might be something like touch of a human or a saddle or being mounted and things like that. And that's a whole big kind of, you know, project really, to train an animal to express consent in that way. But it's a really, you know, Sarah was talking about the dialogue she's got going on with Foxy. That's kind of what I got with Flynn. When I consent trained Flynn and we had this two-way dialogue going on, it was like being propelled to the next dimension. It was crazy, like, and even down to the like the little wrinkles on his muzzle or a blink of an eye, and I could see all this kind of thinking going on and this processing, and I could go, oh, actually I just noticed a little something there, so I think he's a little bit uncomfortable, and I can just back off and I can step it down and listen to him without him even needing to withdraw consent. It's that subtle, and it's just, you know, I've literally got goosebumps even thinking about it. Still makes me so excited. It was just like a real epiphany. And so yeah, if you go on and you kind of stick with it and the horse is physically and mentally, you know, up for being ridden, then it is possible. But in terms of people that I know who have done it and done it successfully and done it via the system, the numbers are very few, because it is a real time commitment. It's not the same as just taking a horse to a mountain block, giving him a carrot, jumping on, giving him another carrot. It's a really sophisticated kind of concept. But, you know, for years I did go through that question of, you know, we don't need to ride them, so why do we? Do you know what I mean? And, you know, what's in it for the horse? Okay, yeah, he's getting some food. So it isn't a clear-cut thing. All I know is that I haven't been able to successfully train Flynn to be ridden by me in spite of all our years of training. And I think that that's a multi-issue thing. So I think it's potentially ongoing pain. He's under the vet at the minute. He's on pain relief at the moment because he has these ongoing issues. And even when he didn't appear to have issues, I think there was probably still something going on there, and we've really, really looked for it, but there's still no concrete diagnosis. But, you know, going back to that systematic physical and mental abuse from the day he was born, his body is wrecked. It is wrecked, you know, and he's only just coming up 10 years old. And then on the other hand, I've got some horses in my life that I'm very fortunate to have, who belong to my friend who runs an animal sanctuary, and she's got 40 odd horses, lots of which, you know, haven't had the same level of training or kind of abuse that Flynn had. And some of those are happy to be ridden. So I think it very much depends on the individual and your commitment to the training and stuff. But I think there is a very valid question there about, well, why are we doing that, you know, do we need to do that? But certainly for horse charming, that is never the focus. It's about level 8 on a 10 tier thing, so there's so much work to be done before you even think about it. And Max Easy, who wrote it, says riding is icing, but first you need a cake, and you ain't got cake. basically. And she will say that to people. She'll say, you ain't got cake. And they're like, what? She's like, riding the icing, but you haven't got cake. So don't even worry about icing right now. That, and she said to me when I first approached her about Flynn, and I said, I want to train him to ride him force free and I want to be able to handle him safely and all of that. And she went, I think you should forget about riding him because he is too broken and too damaged and he's never going to be a safe riding horse. And to this day, she's still right about that.
Join us next time for part two of Anthrozoology Speaks with Hound Charming.